Today, I'm going to respond to patron Florence's email. She said earlier this year, 2016, "I've recently become a patron of your podcast. I love it. They're very informative, and your voice is very soothing. Your voice is very, very soothing." I've never thought about my voice as being soothing. I've often thought about my voice as being very nasally and not very pleasant. When I hear it on recordings, I often cringe at it. But I'm glad one person on the planet considers it not annoying. She goes on to say, "I was wondering if you could perhaps do an episode on bipolar disorder." Well, sure. I'll do a short episode about it. As a caveat, I will say I'm not an expert on bipolar. There are people in my field that are experts, and there are people in my field that treat it much more often than I do. And so I just have to say that it might, you know, for people outside of the field, they might not realize that in our field of psychotherapy and psychology, there are so many different areas and so many different types of jobs, shall we say, that what that means is there are some things that even in my 20 years of being a therapist, I have very little experience with. For instance, with schizophrenia, I am thinking I have never had a client that had schizophrenia. So, and that, you know, might surprise some people. I get it would be akin to if you're a physician and you specialize in, you know, the ear, nose, and throat, there's a chance that you'll never treat, say, I don't know, genital warts or something. I think to people outside of medicine, they understand that because they go to these different doctors when they have an issue. But for some reason, when it comes to psychotherapy and psychology, it's assumed that we know everything about everything. And why would that be? Why would that be the case when there's really just so many things? So bipolar is something that I don't specialize in. It's not something I try to get experience in. It's not something I try to get knowledge of. I've only randomly come across it in my practice because occasionally I'll get a referral for it. You know, someone will contact me and say that they want help with it, and I will determine that I have enough expertise to help them with where they're at. And so what I would do, so I thought instead of just going over the DSM criteria and all that boring stuff, I thought I would just actually describe to you a few presentations that I've experienced in my career and in my personal life as a way of describing it, because bipolar is complicated. And it has a lot of different nuances and a lot of different presentations, particularly when we get outside of the classic presentation. If you don't know, bipolar is the new word, the word that's been used for the past 20 some odd years for manic depression. And the general tagline is you have bouts of depression, which most people understand, and you have bouts of mania. And mania is something that most people don't understand because it's kind of rare. But I'll get more into that as I describe these people. Okay, so I'll tell you about a kind of classic severe bipolar presentation. This was a client, and he, as a his parents had mood disorders, so there was obviously a genetic component in him developing the disorder. As a child, reportedly he didn't have any symptoms. As a teenager, he didn't have any noticeable symptoms. In his 20s, he started to exhibit some depressive episodes, and some what we call hypomanic, hypo meaning not as severe. You know, you have hyper, which means above, and you have hypo, which means under. And so hypomania means that it's not as severe as full-blown mania. So he would have a minor bouts of mania, but in his 20s, but it wasn't noticeable because it just seemed like he was a fun guy during that time. He was very outgoing when he was hypomanic. He had a lot of energy. He was the life of the party. Everyone liked him. He was always, you know, gathering people around him and doing things, and he would get things done in his life. He would move forward in his career. And then when he was depressed, he wouldn't do any of those things. He would just sit in his room and have a really difficult time with his mood. And then as he got older and he went into his 30s, his manic episodes became worse. And they culminated in a time when he was so manic and hadn't been treated because he hadn't been diagnosed, that he had an episode where he believed that everyone would give him whatever he wanted. So he had this thought, you know, it's sort of like it, the thing about mania is we can all kind of relate to it because we've all had times where we felt very energetic and where we felt like we could get things done. You know, we're just like, okay, today I'm gonna do all this stuff and I'm gonna clean the house and I'm going to contact those people I haven't reached out to in a long time ago. And so we can kind of relate to that. So just times that by 100 or 1,000 or something. And, you know, when we're in those really good moods, we might be more talkative with the person in line at the grocery store. Well, when you're manic and you are in that state, you not only just talk to the person in the line at the grocery store, but you believe that person loves you because you have such an elevated self-esteem and you have such an elevated, grandiose, irrational sense of your own competence and your own charm that you just sort of bulldoze everyone around you. And so he did that. He, for instance, just one of the events that he did was he went into a clothing store and asked for, you know, he was like, oh man, I need some new clothes to match my new found self-esteem. And he pulled some clothes off the rack and he went up to the cashier and, you know, he started befriending the cashier and he, instead of paying for the clothes, he just said, I'll pay you back. You know, hey man, you know, we're friends now. I don't have money in my wallet, but, I'll take the clothes out of the store right now and I'll definitely get you back. And the guy's like, what are you talking about? You can't do that. Even if we were best friends, which we're not, you still have to pay for your clothes. And this individual said, ah, oh, come on, man, we're friends. And then he just walked out of the store. And he did a number of things like that. And the cops were called naturally. And then when the cops arrived, he again tried to befriend. Oh, come on. You know, I don't need to be arrested. Everything's fine. And the cops are like, you know, we're taking you in. And then he became very angry at the police officers and everyone else, because in his mind, he was a perfect individual and had nothing wrong with him and had done nothing wrong. He was just talking to his friends and he was just borrowing things. And what's the big deal here? And so that was his big manic episode. He was detained and then forced into treatment. And that's when I met him shortly after that, put on medication and, you know, really struggled. The medication didn't work all that well for him. And so he would still have long bouts of at least mild depression, if not moderate, and would occasionally have manic episodes, particularly when his medication was changed or when he went off his medication. He also had a lot of anxiety and a lot of shame, because when he came down from his manic episodes, he would reflect back on these manic times and would be extremely ashamed of his behavior. He really struggled with isolation and with self-esteem, and so I would talk with him about that, and it was really tough to see, because there was not a lot I could do to help him. I definitely tried, But psychotherapy can only go so far. I can definitely try to help him with how he sees his mood disorder and try to normalize and try to help him heal from the wounds of you know, being ashamed and saying, look, it's not your fault. I mean, if it's a mental illness that you're afflicted with, and you can't be responsible necessarily for your behavior when you're in a manic episode, because you have a different sort of brain in that moment. And so we would talk a lot about reframing and how his, how he saw his situation and his narrative story of his life, rather than I'm a loser, I'm broken. It was, I'm a survivor of mental illness, and I am going to persevere through this. And I'm strong. That was the narrative I was occasionally getting him into. So that's one presentation, and that's kind of a classic presentation in that you see signs of it developing teenager 20s, and then it really kicks in late 20s, early 30s. And you see these, you know, months long bouts of depression, and then short bursts of occasional mania. And the episodes get more pronounced as the person ages. The part that's a little different is that he was to some extent, which I haven't mentioned yet, he was to some extent delusional during his manic episodes. And that that definitely is a feature of severe bipolar, or a kind of bipolar, if you will. But there are plenty of people with bipolar who don't have psychosis or delusions. I think, if I remember right, his delusions developed into him believing that he could do anything, that he had magical powers. And so, you could imagine being, again, in a really good mood, and if you times that by 100 or 1,000, you might think that you're a god, that you can do anything, that you have magical powers. Another presentation I'll tell you about, which is, I think, also typical of what we would call psychotic bipolar, or bipolar with let's see, what's their specific language in the DSM? They'll say bipolar with either mood congruent or mood incongruent psychotic features. So this guy came to me, again, around 30. He was a professional, had a good job, and he came to me because he wanted to talk about anxiety and relationship problems, and I think career problems. And it was all very typical at first. He had very typical complaints. He had very typical goals in therapy, for me anyway. And he, long story short, over the span of several months, he descended into his first major manic episode. The first signs of it were he would tell me about his mother saying really nasty things to him. So he would say, yeah, you know, my parents came and visited me, and under, my mom's breath, she would say things like I was, a piece of shit, and that I was a terrible person. And I was like, whoa, your mom said that to you? And he's like, yeah. And so we would talk about how he felt about that. And he would describe how no one else could hear her say these things. And he would describe how she would say it in such a way that even though his dad would be sitting right there with them, he couldn't hear it. And he would describe it that she would say these things in between words that she'd be saying. So she'd be talking about, yeah, so I went to the doctor, you're a piece of shit. And the doctor said, you know, you're a terrible person. And I just thought, wow, like what kind of person is this mother? Now, at the time, there weren't any other signs of bipolar or psychosis or delusions. And So I believed him. I just thought that this mother of his was this terribly abusive person, and you know, just thought how horrible that would be to have a mother like that. And then as time went on, he started talking about how there was this guy at work who was reading his thoughts or breaking into his computer or something. And then he started talking about guys across the street who were reading his thoughts and had tapped his apartment and were spying on him. And then he started talking about how the government had put a secret message into his car stereo and how he had heard this long statement from, you know, the CIA or something, telling him all sorts of things and telling him to do all sorts of things. And this is so, you know, each one of these things was progressing as the months went on. And then in one moment in my office, a dog barked outside. So we're sitting there in my office talking, and this dog barks next door. And he said, "So did you hear that dog?" And I said, "Yeah, I heard that dog." And he said, "Well, the government has infiltrated that dog's mind and has told the dog to bark to alert me to not tell you anything. You know, that dog is barking because the government doesn't want me to talk to you. The government doesn't want me to talk to anybody. And the government just, you know, made that dog bark to sort of signal to me, to warn me to stop talking to you." And so, you know, as these symptoms emerged, I obviously saw them for what they were, which were delusions and paranoia. And so over time, I started to talk with him about this. And at first, as his mania developed and his delusions developed, I was able to convince him that they were delusions. He was able to say, "Yeah, I'm convinced by you, Kirk, that doesn't make any sense that this guy at work is working for the government and that I have, I have a mental illness right now, and I can see these delusions for what they are." So while his symptoms were still mild, he was able to exert control over them and see them as delusions and see them as mania. He had other manic symptoms as well, staying up all night, having grandiose thoughts about himself and his self-importance and this sort of thing. And all the while, he was extremely afraid of losing his job. He had this very important job, and it was the sort of job where if he were diagnosed with a mental illness, he would automatically be either demoted or moved to another department or something, because the job was so important and so sensitive. And so he, for a while, we really tried to, you know, keep it under control. I obviously sent him to a psychiatrist. The medication wasn't really working. And then it culminated. And then another thing I did was I started involving the family. I started, you know, involving his spouse and his parents and his siblings and his children. And that's another thing that I'll get into later as that really, really helps. But it culminated in him becoming so delusional that he thought that everyone was out to get him, and he was eventually he did something dangerous. I won't go into the details, but he almost killed himself and his family, not on purpose, but he was driving erratically. I'll just say that. But anyway, he ended up in the hospital involuntarily, and he was fully delusional at this point and thought that the doctors were devils and, you know, all this sort of stuff. It was really quite heartbreaking. And it was really heartbreaking for me, because when I first met him months prior to his full blown episode, he wasn't symptomatic. You know, he just had some minor complaints about his career and about his anxiety. And then he had this, you know, peculiar complaint about his mother saying these things. And so when I realized what was happening, I looked back on that original complaint about his mother and realized that that was also a delusion. It was a hallucination. I mean, in all likelihood, right? So that's another presentation. And another presentation is this one guy. He has what we would call in the DSM language hypomanic episode without prior major depressive episode. You can actually have a bipolar or mood disorder that doesn't have any depression, which might sound strange. How can you have, in the DSM language, again, they call it hypomanic episode without prior major depressive episode. Now, this person that I was treating had come to me after he had been hospitalized during his most severe manic episode, in which he never had any delusions, and when he was manic, he just made a lot of bad decisions. He would pull all his money out of retirement and spend it in these really irresponsible ways. And he would act weird at work and tell people, things that indicated that he had this, super high self-esteem, that he could do anything. And he had all these ideas and he's in this really good mood. And, but he never had any noticeable depressive episodes. And so when he got out of the hospital, he entered psychotherapy along with taking his medication. We really talked a long time about his life and trying to figure out, his moods over time. And we both determined that he didn't suffer from depression. He occasionally had bouts of very, very mild depression. But, I was really hesitant to even label it depression because it sounded more like just regular life. And so I determined that he had an odd form of bipolar in which he had very mild manic episodes with almost non-existent depression. And the nice thing about this mild case was that with medication, with his mood stabilizer, with lithium, he was able to not have any episodes over time, over a long period of time. And so, that's how he presented. And he was very self-aware afterwards, after hospitalization, when he was not symptomatic, not going through any manic episode, he was able to look back and say, yeah, that was weird that I did that. And that was weird that I thought that, and I was definitely in a different mood, and I'm so glad I'm on medication, and I'm kind of worried that something bad is going to happen. And with him, a big part of it was learning the warning signs so that he could manage his life, which I'll get into more lately. Okay. So there's some other presentations that I want to get into that don't meet the criteria that I've seen, but these people came to me labeled as bipolar. For instance, one fellow came to me telling me he had bipolar, and but the way he presented, I never really could figure out if it was bipolar or something else. And eventually I just referred him to someone else because he was such a confusing case, and it was actually kind of had a lot of risk factors in terms of him being violent with other people. But the way he presented was he was very angry at a lot of people. He was angry all the time at lots of people, including me. And he was also very confused a lot of the time. And in therapy, he had a really hard time tracking. That's the word we use for paying attention or being able to concentrate on a theme or a pathway in therapy. As him and I would talk, we would be on one topic, and then the next sentence out of his mouth would be something unrelated, or I couldn't tell how it was related. And So I would frequently say, so let's get back to what we were talking about. And he'd be like, oh, okay, yeah, sorry. And then he'd quickly veer into these other realms. And this is potentially a feature of bipolar. And anger and irritability is certainly particularly a male presentation of bipolar. But I couldn't really nail down the cycles of mania and depression with him. And it was also hard because he didn't have a lot of insight, which is also another thing that some bipolar people suffer from, is that as opposed to the other guy I was talking about earlier, who was able to say, oh my God, when I was manic, I did all these crazy things and I don't want to do that again. And I love the fact that I'm taking medication. And so that's what we call high insight, because they can look back, quote unquote, objectively at their own moods and see it for what it is, which is a mood disorder. And for many people with bipolar, they have a really hard time seeing it for various reasons. Maybe it's self-esteem reasons. Maybe their moods are so pervasive to their personality that they can't see the forest through the trees and believe that it's everyone else and not them. You know, when you're manic, you have super high self-esteem and therefore might have a difficult time accepting that there is something different about you. And so with this guy who was very angry and would threaten other people and me, I just never really could pin down if it was bipolar or not. And so, you know, what else could it have been? You know, PTSD comes to mind, narcissistic personality disorder, antisocial personality disorder. I don't know. It was really hard to figure out. Again, mainly because I didn't see any cycles. He was very consistently in the same state every time I saw him. He was always angry. He was always confused. And he always had difficulty thinking and maybe someone out there who treats that sort of thing knows exactly what that is. No disorders come to my mind in terms of what that is. But again, I'm not an expert in bipolar, and I'm not an expert in other sorts of disorders that exhibit those kinds of symptoms. As a clinician, I tend to deal with people that don't suffer from severe mental illness and who are looking to talk about relationships, you know, like divorce, or they want to improve their marriage, or they're having trouble with their self-esteem, or, you know, mild cases, let's just put it that way. Another person that came to me labeled as bipolar was this teen girl who was very angry a lot of the time and very defiant and hated her parents, whereas when she was younger, she loved her parents, and her parents seemed to be good parents, non-abusive parents, good enough parents, and she hated them, and she was often in a bad mood, and she had a lot of difficulty coping with feelings, and she would self-injure as a way of coping. And she came to me, the family had said she has bipolar, she's been diagnosed, and with her, I could never figure out what that was, again, because there didn't seem to be a cyclical nature to it. There doesn't always need to be cyclical nature to bipolar and related disorders, but there wasn't any cycling, there wasn't any ups and downs, and again, she was very consistently angry, very consistently in a bad mood, and she had low insight. I don't know if that's because she's a teenager or what, but so there are other possible things it could have been, but borderline comes to mind. Borderline and bipolar often are misunderstood to each other, and I won't go into all the nuances on that, but it could have been that. So I was never really quite sure about her. And that's the other thing, is that when it comes to these cases that don't fit the quintessential description of a particular disorder, you will find that depending on the clinician, you'll get a very different diagnostic idea about what that is. So if this teenager went around to 10 different clinicians, you would get a lot of different diagnoses. Whereas the guy that I talked about earlier, who had hypomanic episodes with no depression, most people would say, oh, it sounds like you have, bipolar 2 without much noticeable depression or something like that. Or they would say specifically, you have other specified bipolar and related disorder, namely hypomanic episode without prior major depressive episodes. And so there are some presentations that you'll get a lot of agreement on the label, but there are plenty of presentations that will not get a consensus regarding what DSM label to put to it. And that can be very frustrating, not only to clients, but also to clinicians, because as clinicians, we want to feel like we're good at our job and that we know how to label things, right? And when we say things like, I don't know what to call this, it for a lot of clinicians, that's a tough thing to say for them. But there are so many different cases that I've seen that don't easily fit any criteria. And therefore, you just have to say, well, I don't know. Could be bipolar, could be something else. And in my career, since I don't prescribe medication and since treatment often isn't really affected by the label, I don't really care what the label is a lot of the time. With her, I didn't care what the label was. I knew what to do with her. And that was to develop a strong relationship with her so that she trusted me, and then do whatever I could to change her schemas regarding her life and her family. For her to reach out more and to communicate more effectively with her parents. If she had a complaint, tell them, but don't try to kill her parent. I mean, that's an exaggeration. Don't hate your parents. Tell them why you don't like them in that moment. You have the right to complain and to have your parents hear you. You don't have the right to scream and yell at them and say that they're terrible people. That's not helpful. I suppose you have the right to do that, but it's not very helpful. And so, anyway, that's that. I'll tell you about one more person who came to me labeled as bipolar. It was a 7-year-old boy who was having a lot of difficulty at school, and they actually he was in what they call it behavior disorder, disability, or I can't remember what they used to call it, or maybe they still call it, but there are certain classrooms at elementary schools that are dedicated to kids that have a really hard time dealing with regular classes. And so it's usually, less than 10 kids, and the instructor is very good at working with this population. And what they had next door to this classroom was this padded room that would lock. I'm not even joking. It was a room in which they would put kids. This is a public school. They would put the kids in this padded room when they were out of control as a way of giving them a timeout. And they would pad the walls so the kids wouldn't hurt anything. It sounds barbaric, and I'm not a specialist in this sort of thing, so I don't know what to say about it. It seemed strange, but who am I to say? Because I'm not an expert. But when this 7-year-old would have a angry episode in which he would scream and yell, it would last for hours, and they would put him in this room. And by others, his psychiatrists and other people, they were saying he's definitely bipolar. And I thought, okay, if that's what you think, but it's hard to tell with 7-year-olds, is it a phase? Is it something else that the 7-year-old can't articulate? Maybe the 7-year-old has a legitimate thing that is upsetting him and he just isn't able to tell us what's wrong. Is it some medical problem? Does he have irritable bowel syndrome and he's in, just in a terrible mood because of that? With 7-year-olds, it's hard to do it. And some people actually refuse to diagnose 7-year-olds with such things as bipolar because of this reason that kids change. And also it's hard to assess kids because they don't necessarily tell us everything that's happening. And so, but he was definitely labeled bipolar, and I thought I would share it with you. again, the feature that was really latched onto by the other clinicians was that his anger episodes would last for hours, and he would scream and scream and scream nonstop, no joking. For he would just stop to take a breath. I'm not even exaggerating. He would do that for 5 hours at a time. And it was believed back then anyway by many clinicians that that kind of behavior can only be the result of bipolar. And I always thought, don't we need more criteria to be endorsed other than just that? And even that isn't really quintessential bipolar. But, you know, maybe they have research showing that kids who do that kind of thing, the majority of them are diagnosed with bipolar as adults as well. I don't know. But anyway, so just getting into the treatment a little bit. And again, I just want to say as a caveat, I'm not an expert in bipolar. I've only come across, 10, 20 different cases in my 20 years. They're very memorable. I'll put it to you that way because it's quite a scary situation. But okay, so treatment. Well, mainly it's medication and mainly lithium, which is what they call a mood stabilizer. There are other mood stabilizers that are similar to lithium, but I won't get into that. Lithium has been used since mid 20th century. It's a very old drug. We currently have no idea how it works. As with a lot of, to some extent, we still don't even know how SSRIs like Prozac work. There are different theories as to why antidepressants work. But anyway, we really have no idea why lithium works. It just seems to work. And for many people with classic bipolar, lithium is a wonder drug. It just completely stabilizes their mood. It eliminates their manic episodes and it mitigates their depressive episodes. And for some people, it's a life changer. Their whole life is made manageable by lithium. The problem is that lithium can harm the body and it needs to be monitored over time. And some people have to go off of lithium because it harms your organs. Other drugs that are used antipsychotics and antidepressants to a lesser extent. So medication is a big thing for bipolar. It's a crucial element in the treatment of bipolar. And for people that have even mild bipolar and they don't take their medication, it's a scary world without medication. I don't know the statistics, but I would say a good 90% of people with bipolar need to take their medication. It's highly advised that they take it. And along those lines, I'll say that, mania itself, when you're hypomanic or just, barely just sort of manic, that is a wonderful place to be. For people who have bipolar, they actually will go off their medication sometimes because they miss being kind of manic. They don't miss being full-blown manic, and they don't miss being depressed, but they miss being kind of manic because think about it. If you were just kind of manic, think about all the stuff you could get done. People who are kind of manic, they get so much stuff done, and they're so outgoing and so charming and so motivated, and they have so much energy, and they have so much self-esteem. Just imagine if you could have a state like that. All of us would love to have that. And bipolar people will miss that because when you go on a mood stabilizer, it takes that away. It takes away the depression. It takes away the severe mania, and it takes away the mild mania that feels good. And you just feel normal, like a normal American with a boring life. And you know that if you go off your medication, there's a chance that at least for a time, maybe a week or two, you'll feel fantastic. Now, that 2 week period of time that you feel fantastic is followed by months of terrible mania and terrible depression. But a lot of people go off their medication because they want that feeling back. And so when I've talked with people with bipolar, a big part of it is convincing them that Yes, that is a loss in their life and they have to grieve that. But if they're thinking about going off their medication to have that feeling again, they must understand that they are also inviting into their life a lot of terrible things. So if they want that 2 weeks of hypomania, they also are agreeing to have 49 weeks of terribleness. Now, of course, there's no way to definitively know that, but you know, if the past is any predictor of the future, you know, their past moods, swings can, you know, be a deterrent to them going off their medication. Okay. So medication is a big part of it. The other part of it is self-awareness. A lot of people with bipolar have a path of self-awareness, and the more self-aware they are, the better. They can sometimes, like I said, have very low insight, but the more self-awareness they have, the better, because they're in the driver's seat often of their treatment and of how to cope. Which leads me to another thing is stress management. They have to learn how to manage their stress. They have to learn their triggers, because their mood swings can be triggered by stressful life events. And so mood regulation, emotional regulation become to some extent a way of managing bipolar. If you have superior emotional regulation skills, is that going to eliminate your bipolar? No, because your brain is just going to have these natural swings. But you can reduce the frequency of the swings and the severity by having stress management, trigger management, emotional regulation. Another thing is that that I will often do as a family therapist is involve the family. You got to get the family involved. You have to start working on the system. Often you will find that someone else in the client's system will be a stress and will cause symptoms to be exacerbated. Also, you want to educate the family on it, because the family members are the people who are going to see early signs of bipolar. These people are very attuned to the patient's moods and know where that patient is. So, you know, the best person often to talk to is the patient's spouse. And for instance, you know, with one client with bipolar I was working with, I met with the wife frequently and would ask her, so what, you know, where would you place his mood currently? And she'd say, well, he seems a little down, but not too bad. And then a few weeks later, I would ask her, where do you place his mood? And she said, well, you know, he seems normal and stable, like in the middle. And then I might ask her a little bit later and she might say, well, you know, he's been showing some signs of early mania, you know, because I've seen this before. The last time I saw this set of behaviors, a few weeks later, he had full blown mania. So spouses are often excellent people to talk to, because the patient might not see that. In fact, usually the spouse is a better gauge of the patient's mood than the patient is themselves. So that's a big reason, because when you get early warning signs, there are a number of things you can do. You can change medication, but perhaps more importantly, you can start to eliminate the temptation to have a lot of self-destruction. For instance, you know, say you're working with a bipolar patient and you're talking with the wife. The wife says, yeah, I'm starting to see some very concerning things over the past few weeks, and I think we're heading into another manic episode. And the patient is saying, well, oh no, that's no good. That's kind of scary. Well, if the patient, you know, falls into a full-blown manic episode, the patient won't necessarily be on board with even the diagnosis. You know, when people are full-blown mania, they might look at their psychiatrist and say, what are you talking about? I don't have bipolar. You guys are crazy. Even though earlier they were on board with it. And so when you see these early warning signs, you can start to put in place a lot of protective measures to stave off all the negative effects of an episode. For instance, with some patients that I've worked with, I have made it so that they don't have access to the internet. The internet has made the internet is a attractive nuisance to a lot of people with mental illness. You know, if you're having difficulty with anger or with mania or with thought disorders, this kind of thing, and there's a lot of opportunities online to create havoc and to abuse people, to make threats. If, you know, for some bipolar people, they'll just sit in front of the computer all day long and online and just threaten everyone that they come across. And so that's something that, you know, contributes to a lot of what we call, you know, trolling. You'll see these just awful comments. Well, a lot of those people are suffering from mental illness. I would guess to say that, a majority of them are, because it one person on the, for 16 hours can do a lot of damage on the internet, not only to strangers, but to people they know. They can make threats to people they know. And so one of the ways you can, eliminate the negative consequences to a manic episode is don't give them access to the internet. Just, you know, say, "Oh, I'm sorry, honey, our Wi-Fi is down," or some kind of situation like that. Or you have certain protective things on your computer that don't allow certain things to happen. I don't know. So that's one thing. Another thing is with work. You could work with your employer and say, "By the way, I have bipolar and I love my job and I'd like to work with you on how to help me with this issue." And if you get the employer on board, and so the wife could say to the boss and say, "By the way, so-and-so is entering a manic episode and might need some time off work. Because if he comes into work, he might not only threaten your business, but he might threaten his position. He might get fired. So let's just give him a couple weeks off from work. And when he comes down, he'll come back to work. Is that okay?" So there's a lot of things you can do to manage people's lives so that they don't completely destroy their lives when they enter an episode. So those are all the different things that treatment entails. A lot of times, sadly, medication is the only thing that is applied, and all these other things are not. Emotional regulations. Another thing I should mention is that a fair amount of psychotherapy can work too, in terms of helping people with their self-esteem, helping people, because, you know, people with bipolar, it's not like their lives are perfect outside of their bipolar. They have all the same regular problems that everyone else has. You know, they might have problems in their marriage. They might have trauma issues from their childhood that need to be healed. And so all those things can be addressed in psychotherapy. All right. Well, that does it for this episode. If you haven't become a patron, please do so. For instance, this was a response to an email from patron Florence. When you're a patron, you get preferential treatment for emails and all sorts of other things. You also get access to our premium episodes. Again, just everyone, if you don't get episodes updating to your phone, know that that was because I'm handing over the podcast feed to an organization that will start putting ads on the podcast, and I'm worried that something wonky is going to happen. And so just, figure out a way to get the feedback. My guess is you just have to unsubscribe and resubscribe. Also, you might find that when this transition happens, it might download every single episode onto your phone that we've ever done. And we've had hundreds. So, I've been told that that's a possibility. And so if that happens, you know, watch out for that. All right, well, that does it for this episode. Thanks for joining me out there. Please take care of yourself, because you deserve it.